right, welcome back to another installment of Worldwise with your host, DJ Scrappy. Worldwise is a show about science, technology, the environment, and anything else that makes you go, oh, hey, that's pretty interesting. So first order of business for today. We have a bill here in California to limit vaccine exemptions, and let's dive right into that. So this comes from NPR, a California bill that would allow students to opt out of mandatory school vaccinations only if they have a medical condition that justifies an exemption is one step closer to becoming law here, and though it still has a long way to go, it's gaining ground. The bill was introduced in the California Senate in response to a measles outbreak at Disneyland in late December. That's now linked to almost 150 infections. Among several hundred supporters and protesters outside the Capitol building in Sacramento on Wednesday, the bill sparked a debate about individual rights and responsibilities. Opponents wore American flags. One child held a sign that said, "Force my veggies, not my vaccines." They say eliminating the personal belief exemption threatens their ability to do what's right for their kids. "I think that everybody should be able to make their own choice," says Lisa Kadrian of Los Angeles. She fears vaccines would harm her daughter. "I'm afraid that her big, beautiful blue eyes will not focus on me anymore, and she won't be the kid that she is," Kadrian said. But scientific studies show no link between vaccines and autism spectrum disorder, and inside the hearing, parents also talked about protecting their kids from children who aren't vaccinated. Democratic Senator Luis Wolk is on the Senate Health Committee and spoke on behalf of the pro-vaccine parents. "Our individual rights aren't without limits, and in this particular case, your insistence on your right really could harm my children or my grandchildren," said Wolk. The Health Committee in California Senate passed the bill on Wednesday on a 6-2 vote. That was just the first step, though. The proposed legislation has many more hearings before it could become law. Meanwhile, Washington, Oregon, and North Carolina have also considered legislation to limit families' rights to opt out of mandatory vaccinations. And all of those efforts have so far been stalled. So, changes are coming here to California schools. You're listening to Worldwise here at Dominican Radio, radio.dominican.edu. Worldwise is broadcasted from Dominican between the hours of 11 and 12 on Fridays. So if you are hearing this in a podcast, I hope that you can reach us at a later date. Moving on to our next story. There's a dystopian lake filled by the world's tech lust, and this is from the BBC, and they're talking about a place in China. So the city-sized Baogang steel and rare earth complex dominates the horizon, its endless cooling towers and chimneys reaching up into gray, washed-out sky. Between there, stretching into the distance, lies an artificial lake filled with a black, barely liquid, toxic sludge. Dozens of pipes line the shore, churning out a torrent of thick, black chemical waste from the refineries that surround the lake. The smell of sulfur and the roar of the pipes invades the senses. It feels like hell on earth. Welcome to Baotou, the largest industrial city in Inner Mongolia. This reporter went there with a group of architects and designers called the Unknown Fields Division. And this is the final stop on a three-week-long journey up the global supply chain, tracing back the route consumer goods take from China to our shops and homes via container ships and factories. So you may not have heard of the city of Baotou, but the mines and factories there help to keep our modern lives ticking away. Oh, sorry about that. Yes, so Baotou, its factories keep us humming, and it's one of the world's biggest suppliers of rare earth minerals. These elements can be found in everything from magnets to wind turbines, electric car motors, to electronic guts on the smartphone in your pocket, or the flat screen on your TV. In 2009, China produced a whopping 95% of the world's supply of these elements. And it's estimated that the Bayan Obo mines just north of Baotou contain 70% of the world's reserves. But as we would, as the reporter discovered, what's the cost in all this? So these are the elements of success. These rare earth minerals have played a key role in the transformation and explosive growth of China's world-beating economy over the last few decades. It's clear from visiting Baotou that it's had a huge transformative impact on the city. As the center of this 21st century gold rush, Baotou feels very much like a frontier town. In 1950, before the rare earth mining started in earnest, the city had a population of 97,000. Today, the population is more than 2.5 million. There is only one reason for this huge influx of people, and that's the minerals. As a result, Baotou often feels stuck somewhere between a brave new world of opportunity presented by what we have to offer, global capitalism, that depends on it, and the fading memories of a communist state that's still lying in its Soviet-era boulevards. So billboards for expensive American brands stand next to revolution-era propaganda murals as the disintegrated faces of Western supermodels gaze down on statues of Chairman Mao. At night, multicolored lights, glass dyed on by earth, rare earth metals, line the larger roads, turning the city into a scene from the movie Tron, while the smaller side streets are filled with drunk, vomiting refinery workers that spill from the bars and the barbecue joints. Even before getting to the toxic lake, the environmental impact the rare earth industry has had on the city is painfully clear. At times, it's impossible to tell where the vast structure of the Baogang refineries complex ends and the city actually begins. Massive pipes erupt from the ground and run along roadways and sidewalks, arching into the air to cross roads like bridges. The streets here are wide, built to accommodate the constant stream of huge diesel-belching coal trucks that dwarf all other traffic. After it rains, they plow, unstoppable, through roads flooded with water turned black by coal dust. They line up by the sides of the road, queuing to turn into one of Baotou's many coal-burning power stations that sit unsettlingly close to freshly built apartment towers. Everywhere you look, between the half-completed tower blocks and hastily thrown-up multi-story parking lots, it's a forest of flame-tipped refinery towers and endless electricity pylons. The air is filled with a constant, ambient smell of sulfur. It's the kind of industrial landscape that America and Europe has largely forgotten. At one time, parts of Detroit or Sheffield, Scotland, must have looked just like this. When the group visited the city on one of its first tours, it was to a processing plant that specializes mainly in producing cerium, one of the most abundant rare earth minerals. Cerium has a huge number of commercial applications, from coloring glass to making catalytic converters. The guide who showed them around the plant explains that they mainly produce cerium oxide, used to polish touchscreens on smartphones and tablets. As they wandered through the factory, its hangar-like rooms, it was impossible to not notice that something was missing. Amongst the mazes of pipes, tanks, and centrifuges, there wasn't a whole lot of people. In fact, there's no activity in there at all. Apart from the group's voices, which echo through the huge sheds, the plant is pretty silent. It's very obviously not operating. When asked, the guide tells the group that the plant was closed for maintenance. But there's no sign, really, that either there's maintenance crews, no cleaning or repairs being done. And so when pushed further to talk about it, the guide got pretty suspicious and wondered why there were so many questions being asked. And it seems it's a behavior that you'll encounter a lot in Baotou, a refusal to answer questions or stray off a strictly worded script. As they left the facility, one of the party who has visited the area before suggests a possible explanation. Could local industry be artificially controlling market scarcity or producing or products like cerium oxide in order to keep rare earth prices high? Well, we can't know that for sure, that's the case that on the day that they visited. Yet it wouldn't be that unprecedented. In 2012, for example, the news agency Xinhua reported that China's largest rare earth producer was suspending operations to prevent price drops. One of Baotou's other main exports is neodymium, another rare earth with a variety of applications. Again, it's used to dye glass, especially for making lasers, but its most important use is in making powerful yet lightweight magnets. Neodymium magnets are used in consumer electronics items, such as in ear headphones, cell phone microphones, and computer hard drives. At the other end of the scale, they are a vital component in a large equipment that requires powerful magnetic fields, such as wind farm turbines and the motors that power the new generation of electronic cars. The group was shown around a neodymium magnet factory by a guide who seemed more open than the other cerium plant guide. They were even given some magnets to play with. But again, when the questions got a little too off the beaten path, especially about production and the associated environmental costs, the answers started to become less forthcoming, and soon the visit ended. The intriguing thing about both neodymium and cerium is that while they're called rare earth minerals, they're actually fairly common. Neodymium is no rarer than copper or nickel, and quite evenly distributed throughout the world's crust. While China produces 90% of the global market's neodymium, only 30% of the world's deposits are located in arguably what makes it scarce enough to be profitable, and the huge hazardous and toxic process needed to extract them from the ore and refine them into their usable products is why places other than China aren't really into making neodymium. For example, cerium is extracted by crushing mineral mixtures and dissolving them in sulfuric and nitric acid, and this has to be done on a huge industrial scale, resulting in a vast amount of poisonous waste as a byproduct. It could be argued that China's dominance on the rare earth market is less about geology and far more about the country's willingness to take an environmental hit that other nations will not. And there's no better place to understand China's true sacrifice than the shores of Baotou's toxic lake. Apparently, it was created by damming a river and flooding what was once a farmland. The lake is a tailings pond of sorts, a dumping ground for waste products. It takes just 20 minutes to reach the lake by car from the center of Baotou. And on the way, you pass through abandoned countryside dominated by the industrial architecture on the horizon. Earlier reports claim that the lake is guarded by the military, but the group didn't see any. They passed a shack that was presumably a guard hut at one point, but it was abandoned, and whoever was in there left in a hurry, leaving their bedding, cooking, and instant noodle packets. When they reached the shore and looked across the lake, it seemed like something out of a movie. But nothing prepared them for what they actually saw. It was a truly alien environment, dystopian and horrifying. The thought that it was man-made was kind of the most depressing and terrifying thing, as was the realization that this was the byproduct not just the consumer electronics in my pocket, but also green technologies like wind turbines and electric cars. So, kind of leaves one unsure how to feel about it. Because even if you're trying to be earth conscious and green, somewhere someone's taking the hit. So there's this giant toxic lake in China. And you can see it on Google Maps. And from what I'm looking at, it's not the prettiest thing. Enough of that, though. This is Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. And I am your host. My name is DJ Scrappy. Stay tuned, we have some more for ya. All right, welcome back to Worldwise with your host, DJ Scrappy, here on radio.dominican.edu. If you're just joining us, well, what took you so long? All right, we're going to blast right back into another story about the earliest flower fossil ever found. So a tiny flower pressed between layers of sandstone for more than 160 million years could be the oldest flower fossil ever found, says a new study. However, not everyone agrees that the fossil represents an actual flower, or that it is as old as the study claims. Like modern flowers, the fossil sports sepals and petals, the researchers said. However, its age of 162 million years puts it smack in the Jurassic period and in the middle of a passionate debate over the origin of angiosperms, the world's most successful and diverse group of plants. Did angiosperms first bloom in the Cretaceous period, or were they around earlier in the Jurassic period, the heyday of giant plant-eating dinosaurs like Apatosaurus? People will have to rethink everything about angiosperms because of this fossil, said study co-author Xin Wang, a paleobotanist at the Nanjing Institute of Geology and Paleontology in China. Much of the natural history of angiosperms, or flowering plants, seems to be missing from the fossil record. According to fossils, the first plants on land were mosses, which emerged about 425 million years ago. The gymnosperms, a group that includes cycads, ginkgos, and pine trees, were next, followed by ferns. Then, about 125 million years ago, angiosperms and their flowers sprang forth during the Cretaceous period as fully formed as Aphrodite. Within 30 million years, angiosperms would dominate the Earth. Botanists have long wondered how angiosperms and flowers could suddenly flourish without leaving any traces of their ancestry. Charles Darwin called it an abnormal mystery. Scientists also wanted to understand the history of this important lineage, because without flowering plants, humans wouldn't have corn or rice, or medicines like morphine. There are hints that angiosperms may have blossomed before their first fossils appear in rock 125 million years ago. Molecular clocks based on plant DNA suggest angiosperms' origins could extend back to the Jurassic, or even earlier into the Triassic. Tiny pollen grains with angiosperm features have been sifted out of rocks from these ancient eras. Because flowers are fragile and not easily preserved as fossils, perhaps the evidence of absence of it is simply an absence of evidence. Maybe angiosperms were the mammals of the Mesozoic, tiny and small, waiting on the sidelines to take over the world, said David Winship Taylor, a plant evolutionary biologist who is head of biology and curator of the herbarium at Indiana University Southwest in New Albany. He states that, "My own feeling is that we're not looking correctly." He wasn't involved in the research, but Taylor thinks early angiosperms were small plants, similar to flowering herbs. He says, "I suspect that the angiosperms had tiny pollen and we're missing it." Either way, the new reported fossil is unlikely to sway strong opinions on either side of the debate. To claim a Jurassic age flower, researchers need to be absolutely sure of its timing, and in this case, that's impossible. The specimen was collected more than 40 years ago by Quang Pan, a coal engineer who became a self-taught fossil expert after he was sent to the remote village of Sanjiaochang in China's Liaoning province, Wang said. Pan donated the fossil to the researchers. Paleobotanists are leery of claims regarding the oldest flower fossil, because the field was recently burned by a misstated fossil. In 2002, scientists reported a 144-million-year-old Archifructus angiosperm fossil from China, which made a splashy debut on the cover of the journal Science, but the fossil was later redated to 124.6 million years old. This is our strongest evidence of Jurassic angiosperms that we have at this time, but it's tentative, says Taylor, of the new fossil. If this was in the Cretaceous, no one would be arguing about it. but because it's in the Jurassic, you need to have more evidence. Wang said that Pan carefully documented his collections and fossils and volcanic ash found in the same rock layers confirm the flower was entombed during the Jurassic period. The fossil was named Unthus Pani, the first name in Latin for real flower, and the second name is in honor of Pan. I believe that as more fossils are documented from the Jurassic or earlier times, it will develop a new picture of angiosperm evolution that is completely different than what we had for the last 100 years, says Wang. Wang and lead author Zhang Zhanglu of the National Orchid Conservation Center in China placed the new flower species within the eudicots, the largest group of angiosperms. A description of the fossil was published online on March 16th in the journal Historical Biology. The E. pani flower is tiny, just a half inch wide and tall, but it has derived traits. There are male pollen-producing organs, such as sepals and anthers, and enclosed female organs, including a stigma with a receptive surface for pollen. The study reported its separate petals are arranged like those of lilies or poppies. For the botany-minded, Wang said the flower displays a defining characteristic of angiosperms, a four-part anther that contains pollen grains. You don't need to know much about botany. You can recognize it's a flower, says Wang. But the details weren't convincing for several scientists that live scientists contacted for this study. For instance, Patrick Herodine, an evolutionary plant biologist and senior scientist at the Chicago Botanic Garden, said he thinks the fossil is not a flower. He says, "I'm completely unconvinced as to their interpretations of the fossil." Herodine told the Life Science Journal that, "I do not know what the fossil is, but I certainly don't see anything worth reporting." Well, we reported on it anyways here at Worldwise, because you never know. It could be interesting. Moving on to another story. Let's move on to tech, Shelley. So, Spike Lee. What comes to mind when you think of Spike Lee? Probably his movies. Amazon is actually in talks with Spike Lee for the site's first ever big movie. So Amazon is in talks to do so. According to published reports this week, Lee is confirming working on a film called Chirac, and it is pursuing actors like Samuel L. Jackson, Jeremy Piven, Kanye West, and Common for some of the roles. According to the Chicago Tribune, the movie's title is a controversial moniker that compares the city's gun violence and danger level to that of the war zone in Iraq. Lee and Amazon have not commented since The Wrap reported on the project on Wednesday, but Chirac is potentially a very big coup for Amazon Studios, the online retailer's television and movie production division. Back in January, Amazon announced a plan to produce and acquire about 12 movies a year. Adding to the lineup of TV dramas and comedies, it already distributes through Amazon Prime. The plan is to release the movies in theaters first, then have them come out on Amazon's streaming video service 4 to 8 weeks later. This is our attempt to try to find the middle ground, Amazon Studios chief Roy Price told CNN Money in an interview at the Sundance Film Festival. Here's how we described Amazon's ambitions. There are movies people talk about for zero time, there are movies people talk about for 2 weeks, and there are movies people talk about for 2 years or more. Let's try to be in the 2 years or more business. Bloomberg actually reported on Thursday that Chirac would be the online retailer's first high-profile feature film. So, yeah, I grew up right outside Chicago, and big names like Common and Kanye West, I mean, they're from Chicago, so... Yeah, let us see. Okay, so how about a story about health? Medical schools have decidedly taken a turn to reboot for the modern age. So medicine has changed a lot in the past 100 years. But medical training hasn't really, until now. Spurred by the need to train a new, different type of doctor, some top medical schools around the U.S. are tearing up textbooks and starting from scratch. Most medical schools still operate under a model pioneered in the early 1900s by an educator named Abraham Flexner. Flexner did a lot of great things, says Dr. Raj Mangrekar, Associate Dean for Medical Student Education at the University of Michigan Medical School, but we've learned a lot and now we're absolutely ready for a new model. Michigan is one of many med schools in the midst of a major overhaul of their curricula. For example, in a windowless classroom, a small group of second-year students is hard at work. The students are not studying anatomy or biochemistry or any of the traditional sciences. They're polishing their communication skills. In the first exercise, students paired off and negotiated the price of a used BMW. Now, they're trying to settle on who should get credit for imaginary medical journal articles. So, one of them says, I was thinking, kind of given our background and approach, that I would be the senior author. How does that sound to you? Asked Jesse Burke Raphael, a second-year student from Washington State. His partner, also a second-year student, objects. He also wants to be the senior author. Eventually, they both agree to share credit, rotating whose name comes first on subsequent papers related to the imaginary research project that they're working on. Now, that it may seem an odd way for medical students to be spending their class time, but Dr. Aaron McKean, the surgeon teaching the class, says it's a serious topic for students who will have to communicate life and death matters during their careers. McKean says, I was not taught this in medical school myself. We haven't taught people how to be specific about working in teams, how to communicate with peers and colleagues, and how to communicate to the general public about what's going on in healthcare and medicine. It's just one of many such changes, and it's dramatically different from the traditional way medicine has been taught. Flexner's model is known as 2 plus 2. Students spend the first 2 years of their training in the classroom memorizing facts and anatomy. In their last 2 years, med students shadow doctors in hospitals and clinics. Mangrekar says Flexner's approach represents a huge change from the way doctors were taught in the 19th century. Back then, literacy was optional, and you didn't always learn in the clinical settings, he says. Shortly after Flexner published his landmark review of the state of medical education, dozens of the nation's medical schools closed or merged together. But today, says Mangrekar, the 2 plus 2 model doesn't work. For one thing, there's too much medical science for anyone to learn in 2 years, and the practice of medicine is constantly in flux. What Michigan and many other schools are trying to do now is prepare future doctors for the inevitable changes they'll face throughout a long career. We shouldn't even try to predict what that system is going to be like, he says, which means we need to give students the tools to be adaptable, to be resilient, to solve problems, to push through some things, accept them some things, but change other things. One big shift at many of the schools is a focus on how the entire health system works, rather than just training doctors how to treat patients. Dr. Susan Skolchak, a vice president with the American Medical Association, is in charge of an AMA project that is funding changes at 11 schools around the country. She says the new teaching focus on the healthcare system has had an added benefit. Faculty members are learning right along with the students about some of these absurdities. For example, she says, only because they have to guide students through the system do they discover things like the fact that some hospitals schedule patients for MRI and other tests around the clock. And one of my patients had to come and get their MRI at 3 a.m., Shulak said. How do they do that? She says, a faculty member asked her, do they have kids? Well, physicians aren't always the best teachers about how the system works. Doctors tend to focus on patient care, since that's what they're there to do. However, Skolchak says, if you hook students up with a clinic manager, when you want them to learn about the system and what the system does, then a clinic manager focuses on the system. Another major change to medical education aims at helping future doctors work as team players rather than as unquestioned leaders. In a classroom at the University of California, San Francisco, several groups of students practice teamwork by working together to solve a genetics problem. Joe DeRisi, who heads the biochemistry and biophysics department at UCSF, is guiding more than teaching when he gently suggests a student's tactic is veering off course. I would argue that it may not be as useful as you think, he tells the student, but I'm obliging. Onur Yenguin, one of the students in the class, says that working with his peers is good preparation for being part of the team when he's a doctor. When I'm in a small group, I realize that I can't know everything, Yenguin says. I won't know everything, and to be able to rely on my classmates to fill in the blanks is really, really important. The medical schools that are part of the AMA project are already sharing what they've learned with each other. Plans are in the works, as well, to begin sharing some of the more successful changes with other medical schools around the country. So, a much-needed update, because the Flexner model has been in since the early 1900s. And I would like a doctor that's up to date. I don't know about you. This is Worldwise. I am DJ Scrappy. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu, and we will be back shortly with some more news. Welcome back to Worldwise. Okay, so if you were with us earlier in the show, we talked about a tailing pond in China and all the pollution that that is causing. Anyways, so I have another story, kind of similar, but it's on a global scale. It's about the ocean of acid that's blamed for Earth's great die-off. So death by acid was the fate of the sea monsters that perished in Earth's biggest mass extinction some 251 million years ago, a new study finds. nearly every form of ocean life disappeared during this great dying at the end of the Permian period, when more than 90% of all marine species vanished, from the scorpion-like predators called Eurypterids to various types of trilobites, some with alien-like stalked eyes. It's the closest Earth has ever come to completely losing its fish, snails, sea plankton, and other marine creatures. Some 70% of animals and plants on land died off at the same time. Now, there is a direct evidence that ocean acidification dealt the final blow to species already suffering from these huge environmental changes. By analyzing boron embedded in limestone from the Permian and Triassic periods, researchers discovered an abrupt shift in ocean pH levels. The change in acidity corresponds to a drop in surface ocean pH levels of 0.6 to 0.7 pH units that lasted about 10,000 years. In comparison, modern ocean pH levels have fallen by 0.1 pH units since the Industrial Revolution, a 30% increase in acidity. The findings were published today, yesterday, in the journal Science. Most scientists blame a massive volcanic eruption in Siberia for the Permian mass extinction. The Siberian traps pulsed out about 1.4 million cubic miles of lava over millions of years. Evidence suggests that toward the end of the Permian period, the eruptions punched through piles of coal and carbonate rocks, releasing toxic levels of carbon dioxide, sulfur, and other gases into the ocean, or into the air, rather. And ocean acidification is driven by excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which in turn dissolves into the ocean. This was a pretty enormous change in acidity, said the lead study author, Matthew Clarkson, who is a geochemist and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He says, "I think it might be a massive warning and a worst-case scenario if we carry on with fossil fuels. Diversity didn't recover for 5 million years," Clarkson told the Science Journal. Clarkson examined boron from a section of limestone in the United Arab Emirates that was deposited on the supercontinent of Pangaea's ancient shores. The study was conducted with colleagues from the universities of Edinburgh and Exeter in the United Kingdom and the University of Bremen in Germany. In modern seawater, boron isotope levels are controlled by ocean acidity. Scientists can measure the ratio of these isotopes in seashells and sediments deposited in the ocean today to gauge pH levels, and perform the same tests in rocks and fossils that are millions of years old. The new study indicates that there were two pulses of environmental change during the 60,000-year extinction event. The pH drop detected by the boron isotopes comes near the end of that event, about 50,000 years after the Great Dying starts. Sudden shifts in carbon and oxygen isotopes kick off the extinction, along with the first disappearance of organisms in the fossil record. Then the boron isotope changes show up. Surprisingly, the pH shift doesn't happen during what most of us have considered the big event, said Lee Kump, a geochemist at Penn State University in University Park, Pennsylvania. He was not involved in the current study. However, the team needs to confirm that the acidification pulse was a worldwide phenomenon, says Kump. It's an interesting result, but it's not conclusive. He thinks we need more of these sections around the world to validate it. The gap between the when each isotope records jump, the first carbon, then boron, could mean that the Earth's ocean slowly absorbed the first wave of excess greenhouse gas from the eruptions, Clarkson said. Then another burst of activity about 10,000 years before the end of the Permian period triggered a mass die-off due to ocean acidification. So, a cautionary tale from the Permian period. The Permian mass extinction almost ended life as we know it on the planet, and death by acid does not sound fun. So, what else doesn't sound fun? Well, residents are fighting Mark Twain National Forest restoration plans. So the U.S. Forest Service wants to use fire, herbicides, and chainsaws to cure ailing woods in the Mark Twain National Forest along the Missouri-Arkansas border. So there's been a feud along this border, and it's in the Mark Twain Forest. It's a large and dense area in Butler Hollow. The U.S. Forest Service has a plan to use fire and herbicides and chainsaws to thin out the woods there. But the residents there are fighting this plan. A chorus of tree frogs called Spring Peepers sings to Jo Nell Korn. She walks through the Mark Twain Forest and reflects on five generations of her family who thrived on the cold springs, rushing creeks, and steep oak forests of Butler Hollow. Jo Nell says, "To see all the natural beauty, and I guess unfortunately, we took it all for granted because we just thought it would always be here, especially with it being a national forest." She's standing in Chute Ridge, a scrub landscape in the hollow, covered in ghostly dead oaks, recently thinned and burned by the forest survey. Jo Nell is not very happy. "We look at it as devastation. We look at it as destruction. To us, that's not a turn or a picture of management." Jo Nell wants the forest left alone, and so do dozens of angry families who swarmed a recent USDA Forest Service meeting. A dozen rangers guide them to colorful posters that illustrate plans to restore most of the land in Butler Hollow. 88-year-old Wayne Walden is upset as he holds up a faded photograph of his homestead. "Mother Nature does a wonderful job in Butler Hollow all of my life," says Walden. "Centuries ago, this land was covered with ancient white oaks and limestone glades, groomed by a perennial wildfire. Settlers, though, set about hacking the forest to use the wood for railroad ties and barrels. After the Forest Service took possession decades later, logging and fire suppression created a dense thickets of red oaks. Now aromatic cedars are moving in, which the Forest Service considers invasive. So District Ranger Joe Kolowski says it's time Butler Hollow returns to its roots." Joe says, picture a setting where tree density is relatively low. There are a lot of gaps in the canopy that allow a lot of sunlight to hit the ground. And in the understory, very rich in grasses, herbs, and flowers. Plans call for a third of the 1.5 million acre Mark Twain National Forest to be restored. Opponents say it's just an excuse to log public lands. Timber sales on the Mark Twain last year brought nearly $4 million to the U.S. Treasury. But forest planner Rich Hall says that's not it. Rich says, "We are not in the business of making money. We're in the business of managing land, and we're managing it for ecosystem health and for society." Hall welcomes the public debate about the forest planning, he says, "as long as it's based on science and not sentiment." One critic says restoring forests to the way they looked long ago should not be the mission of the U.S. Forest Service. Andy Stahl is executive director of the Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. He says the government's growing penchant for historic landscaping must stop. "Today's national forests have no more relationship to what this landscape looked like in 1500 than do the cornfields of Iowa." The Forest Service says the restoration of the Mark Twain is not a done deal. Some plans may be scaled back. They'll make a draft decision in the next few months. So I guess that means we're going to have to keep looking. But if they're already selling $4 million worth of timber there, I think it's a done deal. This is Worldwise. I'm your host, DJ Scrappy. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. Another beautiful Friday. 11 to 12 Worldwise, where you get your science, environmental news, and technology. Speaking of technology, has anyone seen the new Fast and Furious movie? Well, one of the biggest stars of that movie isn't a car, it's a plane. The film producers hired a Lockheed C-130 Hercules to fly five cars 12,000 feet high and open a cargo door at the rear of the plane and parachute them out in a spectacular free fall stunt. Well, Geronimo. But seriously, happy birthday to, well, happy 60th birthday, rather, to the Hercules, the oldest continuously produced family of military planes in history. Lockheed has been making these airplanes longer than the legendary B-52 bomber and the famous U-2 spy jet. Unlike those planes, the C-130 has never become a household name. The fact that Furious 7 producers chose a plan that was designed in the 1950s, choose the plane, sorry about that, tells you a little something about the success of the Hercules. The film makes it appear as if another plane, a C-17 Globemaster III, drops the cars, but in real life, it took a Hercules to pull it off. Shooting the scene posed unique logistical challenges, said stunt coordinator Jack Gill in a featurette video about the mission. He says, you start throwing all those cars out together, you got to figure out spacing, and these things drop really fast, says Gill. Jeremiah Bowden, an International Air Response co-piloted the stunt. He says, we have to be very precise in our headings and our altitudes. The Hercules is big, it's tough, and it's versatile. It refuels helicopters in flight, it can fly a small military force and its heavy equipment around the world, and land on short, unfinished airstrips. At Lockheed's Marriott, Georgia factory in 1955, the governor of Georgia christened the first production C-130A by smashing a bottle of Chattahoochee River water across its nose. The plane then proceeded to take off from nearby Dobbins Air Force Base. On Tuesday, exactly 60 years later, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal recreated the ceremony, christening a brand new Super Hercules during a birthday party of sorts for Lockheed's executives and military dignitaries. He says, I'm told that the 2,500th version of this aircraft is now on the assembly line inside this very building. It's become a war airplane as necessary, and it is recognized as the true workhorse. Inside the plane's cockpit, Lockheed test pilot Steve Knobloch said he's done a lot of airdrop testing while flying C-130s. We've dropped some crazy things out, says Knobloch. Airdropping a car out of an airplane is easy. Whatever we can fit inside the cargo hold, we can drop out the back. Several factors come into play for a pilot making a drop, says Knobloch, including payload weight, wind speed, and of course, timing. We have to give time for the car to clear the airplane, let the parachute deploy, and then actually open, he said. One tricky decision involves how high the plane drops its cargo. There's a trade-off between dropping it low and being more accurate, and dropping it high where you have a little more safety in how it will land. Knobloch also explained how the C-130's robust landing gear helps the plane survive difficult landing conditions. The pilot gets to decide how hard the touchdown's going to be, he says. Sometimes, to get his performance, he needs to really let it crunch on the ground, but the airplane can handle it. Meanwhile, in the back of the plane, Lockheed loadmaster Lucky Madsen showed off the plane's new reversible deck, which makes it easier to switch the floor from a flat surface to a floor with rollers embedded in it. The rollers make it easier to move cargo around and launch it out the back of the other plane. The legacy surrounding the Hercules has been built by 60 years of successful missions. These missions include saving a hurricane hunter. So in that episode, in 1989, a flight crew aboard a Hercules named Teal 57 was credited with saving the crew of a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Hurricane Hunter airplane. While flying through Hurricane Hugo, the NOAA plane lost an engine and suffered damage to a second engine. Teal 57 happened to be nearby and located a safe place for the NOAA plane to escape the eye of the deadly Category 5 storm. Everyone returned safely to base. In another instance, in 2012, Israeli Brigadier General Joshua Shani revealed how he flew a Hercules on a successful hostage rescue mission to Entebbe, Uganda. Four C-130s helped rescue passengers from a hijacked Air France flight in 1976 at some places that were particularly dangerous. We flew at an altitude of 35 feet to evade radar. And he says, trust me, that was scary. And also in wartime, it's dropped off a lot of bombs. During the military buildup of 2003, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, a Hercules test dropped the biggest conventional weapon in the Pentagon's arsenal, a so-called MOAB, mother of all bombs, known as military... Yeah. A C-130 ejected the 21,000-pound bomb out its rear cargo door high above Florida's Elgin Air Force Base. The bomb fell to Earth and detonated in a spectacular fireball. So, when I was in the Coast Guard, I know we had the C-130J, and I didn't know that there's been over 2,500 versions of this single plane. But I can dig it. Moving forward, let's talk about the definite evidence of alien life within 20 to 30 years. That's what NASA's chief scientists are saying. There will be a strong indications of alien life within a decade and definite evidence of it within 20 to 30 years, says NASA's chief scientists. They say that we know where to look, we know how to look. And during a panel discussion on Tuesday, Ellen Stofan went into more detail on NASA's search for alien life in habitable worlds. He says, in most cases, we have the technology and we're on a path to implementing it. But she was quick to add, we are not talking about little green men. We are talking about little microbes. Her colleague, John Grunsfeld, a former astronaut and associate administrator for the agency's science mission directorate, agreed. I think we're one generation away in our solar system, whether it's on an icy moon or on Mars, and one generation away on a planet around a nearby star, Grunsfeld said at that same discussion. Jeffrey Newmark, NASA's interim director of heliophysics, added, it's definitely not an if, it's a when. Scientists have been searching for extraterrestrial life for years, and one way of doing it was by searching for alien air pollution. And recent discoveries suggest that several nearby planets and their moons could support some form of life. For example, last month scientists said they thought there was a warm ocean on Saturn's moon Enceladus. A NASA scientist confirmed that Jupiter's moon Ganymede has a salty ocean below its surface. Scientists believe that the presence of water is one possible sign of life. So 20 to 30 years. Okay. I'll wait till I see the little green men. Alrighty. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with you here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. Alright, so how about wasabi? You guys like sushi? So researchers have discovered the exact structure of the receptor that makes our sensory nerves tingle when we eat sushi garnished with wasabi. And because the wasabi receptor is also involved in pain perception, knowing its shape should help pharmaceutical companies develop new drugs to fight pain. The receptor, which scientists call TRPA1, is an important molecule in the pain pathway, says David Julius, a professor of physiology at the University of California, San Francisco. and an author of a paper published in this week's Nature magazine, or journal Nature, rather. A dream of mine, he says, is that some of the work we do will translate into medicines people can take for chronic pain. Julius led a team that discovered the receptor about a decade ago. Since then, researchers have shown that TRPA1 receptors begin sending distress signals to the brain whenever they encounter pungent chemical irritants, including not only wasabi, but tear gas and air pollution from cars or wood fires. The receptors are also become activated in response to chemicals released by the body itself when tissue becomes inflamed from an injury or a disease like rheumatoid arthritis. But Julius also wants to know what that receptor looked like at a level of atoms, something that would tell him a lot about how it worked. And one day in the hallway near his lab, he ran into Yifeng Cheng, a biochemist who is an expert in single particle electron cryomicroscopy. I'm going to skip that word. Which uses an electron microscope to study biological samples at very low temperatures. For a long time, the technique produced only fuzzy images of structures as small as the wasabi TRPA1 receptor, but in the last few years, this technique has undergone a revolutionary leap forward. So the researchers decided to give it a try on TRPA1, and it worked. The biggest advance here is that we can actually see the structures of the molecule, and we can see the atoms in the molecule, says Julius. So, knowing your wasabi receptor can help science fight pain. Well, that's all we have for you today on Worldwise. Thank you for tuning in. If you missed any of the show, head over to radio.dominican.edu. You'll find shows like Worldwise on there. You'll also find other student shows under student podcasts, so be sure to look that up. Other than that, this is DJ Scrappy signing off. Thank you again for another beautiful Friday. It was fantastic. And if you feel like it, next Friday I will be here, 11 to 12. Adios.